the field turns for home.
They're at the top of the stretch.
Top of the stretch.
They're into the stretch.
And here they come into the final furlong.
Final furlong.
Final furlong.
Into the final furlong.
They go inside the final furlong.
This is the final furlong on HRRN Live.
HRRN Live.
It's Trainer Talk Wednesday. Now, here's Mike Pena and Jude Feld.
Wednesday afternoon from 6 to 7 Eastern Time, we'll visit with top trainers all over the country. And looking forward to getting into some of those discussions and getting in depth as we talk to them at kind of an elongated interview, because Jude, so many times we have the opportunity to talk to these trainers, but we only talk to them on a very short basis, maybe a 10 or 12 minute interview. For example, today, Ron Ellis is going to be here in a few minutes and he's going to join us for this entire hour. Imagine what we can talk about there.
Yeah, a regular Charlie Rose show for horse racing. But, you know, Ron's a very talented guy. He's a consummate horseman. He's a fellow broadcaster. He's been on the racetrack for quite a long time. We'll let him tell you how long. But
I had read somewhere in one of his biographies as I was doing a little research on Ron Ellis. Fascinating stuff,
Thank
by
you,
the way.
James Lipton.
Yeah, fascinating stuff. that he actually saw his first live thoroughbred race at the age of 16.
Yeah, that's a little late to start.
Yeah.
You know, everybody shows up the track sooner or later. Somebody brings him out. We'll have to find out who that was and see how it goes. But talk about somebody who's in love with the sport. I mean, Ron loves racing. But he's not a one-dimensional guy either. He loves all kinds of sports. He's a big fantasy sports player. He loves football and baseball. He's an athlete. He's played in the Santa Anita Softball League for many, many years. I mean, there's lots of things that he's done in his life besides horse racing. So he's also got a great family, and he's married to Marty McGee's sister. Marty McGee, one of the top columnists for the Daily Racing Form,
Is he back in our fantasy league this year with fantasy football?
Ron is in the TaylorMade fantasy football
league this year. He jumped ship. He couldn't beat us.
He didn't get in our league last year, and he lost his spot to somebody else. But he has the first opening that comes up in the Friends and Family League, the Beattie Feathers Memorial Football League, it's called.
I just thought that since myself and my good friend Joe Smith teamed up to win that thing last year, that maybe Ron figured, hey, we can't beat these guys. We're going to go to a different league.
Yeah, well, that happens. But
and, yes, Joe Smith actually is a person, by the way. I didn't make that up.
Yeah, no, that's a great story in itself, which we won't get into now.
Well, Ron will be here with us in about 2 or 3 minutes from right now. He asked us to call him back about 5 after 6, so we'll do that here shortly, and he'll be with us for the full hour here on this inaugural edition of Trainer Talk on HRN's final furlong show. We can remind you that we are back here tomorrow afternoon as well, as we come to you live from Santa Anita Park here in Arcadia, California. We are here tomorrow beginning at 3 o'clock Eastern Time with our HRRN live coverage covering races from Belmont Park. And then we will segue into our call-in show, our listener call-in show from 6 to 7. That should be an awful lot of fun. Looking forward to hearing from all of you as you can call into our HRN studios tomorrow afternoon. Let us know what's on your mind, what you're thinking about the world of horse racing or about the Breeders' Cup Challenge races taking place this weekend. And on Friday, we're back here at 3 o'clock Eastern and, of course, 6 to 7 Eastern with our handicapping show, that very first HRN live handicapping show, which will get you ready for all the big races.
Yeah, that's going to be a lot of fun as we prepare for Saturday's events. I mean, just an outstanding group of horses running here at Santa Anita and at Belmont Park in New York, so you won't want to miss that. And you know, on Thursday, call in and tell us who you like. Give us some insight. Anybody that has been doing their homework and has maybe a little secret that they want to share with the world, that's time to call the HRRN live call-in show.
Horse players are very cynical with that kind of stuff. They like to keep that to themselves because they're afraid that they're going to knock the price down if they give out some secret information on a horse, right?
Yeah,
we're all like that.
I'm not like that. I always give the good stuff away. I put the horses on my website that I like. Win, lose, or draw. Sometimes they win, sometimes they lose.
Yeah, because who says that you're right?
Yeah. I mean, I think you have to realize that you're going to be wrong more than you're right. But it's all about the price. That's where the value comes in. And sometimes, you know, things change when you put out your picks early, you know, if you put them out the night before or whatever, and then there's scratches, there's weather, there's jockey changes, all kinds of things can affect a race, as everybody knows. So, you know, you just do the best you can, but I don't keep the good ones for myself. If I like a long shot, I'm not afraid to put them on top, and sometimes they pan out pretty good if I do say so myself.
Yeah.
So what the heck?
Well, we are live from Santa Anita this afternoon, literally, what would you say, 70 yards from the main track? This is how we started the show at 3 o'clock.
I would say I think we're not more than 50, really. But I guess you're talking about to the inside rail or to the outside rail?
To the inside rail. That's where the main track would start, right? Yeah, we are situated about 60 to 70 yards away from the main track.
I'll give you that.
If we were to walk a straight line from here to the main track, it would be about 60 to 70 yards.
I'm assuming that it's about the track's about 20 yards wide. Is that right?
I don't know. Probably.
One stride is a yard, right? If I'm playing golf, one of my strides is a yard. So I'm thinking it's going to take me 20 strides to get across the track. Right? So that's 20 yards.
Well, let's see if Ron Ellis happens to know the answer to this question.
I'm sure
Ron
he
is
does.
With us now here on the inaugural Trainer Talk edition of the Final Furlong on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Ron, how wide is this track here at Santa Anita?
Well, gosh, I don't know. That's a good question. I've never been asked that before, but I think your guesstimate is right at about 20 yards. Sounds good to
about
me.
20 yards. Yeah, it sounds like two first downs. I don't know. It's strange. Well, that's not why we did not summon you here to talk about the width of the Santa Anita main track. We want to hear your life story. It all began when?
Oh boy, a long time ago. I can tell you that. I feel like an old timer inside, though. Of course, I've been holding my outward youth very well.
there you go.
Yeah. Jude, I came on the racetrack when I was 15 years old. That would have been back in 1975, and hot walker, and he was a great mentor for me. I spent 5 years working with him, and he taught me everything that he knew, and he was a great horseman, and was very fortunate to get an opportunity to train my first horse in 1980.
All right, well, I think that Ron is going through a bit of a rough spot there with his cell phone, so we will try to connect with him again here. Lee Delapina back in the studio. Lee, you want to go ahead and give that a shot and see if we can get him back in just a minute, but because we couldn't really understand what he was breaking up there a bit.
Yeah, I don't know where he is. He might be in his man cave.
Yeah, I guess he's on the road driving. He's probably coming from, would you say Hollywood Park? I wanted to ask him where he was.
He could be coming home from Hollywood.
Yeah, so. He has a very busy day coming up on Saturday here as well. Well represented in a couple of big stakes races in the Grade 1 Zenyatta Stakes, formerly the Ladies Secret. He will have Include Me Out under jockey Joe Talamo. We heard from him earlier on the show talking about that filly. And he will also have Rail Trip going postered in the Awesome Again Stakes, formerly the Goodwood, and we'll see if Rail Trip can indeed get the job done in that spot.
Yeah, that's a salty race, but Rail Trip's doing great since he's back under Ron's care. Ron had him for a long time, did quite well with him, made, I believe, like $1.2 million, was relieved of his duties. The horse was sent east to Rick Dutrow. Rick Dutrow had some problems with the horse's feet. Things didn't work out. Ron got the horse back. He's put him back in the winner's circle. He's got him back training the way he used to train, and hopefully everything works out good for him on Saturday.
And Lee Delapina back in our Lexington, Kentucky studios. Lee, when you have Ron, just let us know. We'll get right back to him. He's apparently picking his daughter up at school. So life goes on. It's not just about training horses
no.
for Ron Ellis. There's
well,
other things
you,
involved.
He's got a family, and He's involved in lots of things besides horse racing. He loves horse racing. It's his occupation and vocation and avocation, but he's got other things in his life as well.
Yeah, and you know, you and I talked about this as we were waiting for him to join us, and talking about how he didn't get to the racetrack until he was 16 years old. He said 15 years old. So again, that's a little bit late. You would think most people kind of get started in the business earlier than that. We hear so many stories about people getting started as kids, where they were taken to the track by somebody, or they were just around the game. You know, your kids have been around it because you trained horses out here for 20 years. We had dinner with your daughter Ryan last night, and she said that like the day after she was born, she was at the racetrack.
Yeah, my kids grew up around it, and Ron's kids did too. I mean, Elizabeth was in the winner's circle, you know, at a very, very young age, I'm sure. You know, but she comes from a racing family. I started coming to the races with my father when I was 3 years old. So came out to Santa Anita for the first time. Actually, the first race I ever saw at Santa Anita was a harness race, believe it or not. But we used to come to the races here on a regular basis, almost every Saturday with my dad and my uncle. Every Saturday during the meet, we'd be out, and I saw some amazing races here when I was a kid, and including when Damascus got beat. But you know, it's in my blood. It's a place that I love, and Ron, I'm sure, feels the same way.
You know, I guess because this is a trainer talk segment, I'm very fortunate, because we do have issues with a cell phone like this for a few minutes. You and I can talk about training horses because you did it for 20 years. So I can do a trainer talk segment with you. Joining us on the first trainer talk segment, Jude Feld, kicking things off. Well, but no, you mentioned you were kind of born into it. It was something where you were just kind of around this game from a very young time. I was going to ask Ron this question. I kind of brought it up to you last night. I want to know, in all the years that you were training horses, who was the one horse that you could put your finger on and say, this is the one I'd like to have back? This is the one that could have been special, and it just never quite came together.
Well, the horse that I won my first 100 grander with was a horse named Pewter Gray that my brother Bob had seen run here, and thought that he received an insufficient ride, you might say. And he said he came home. Bob and I lived together at the time. He came home and he said, I saw this horse run today, and you've got to claim him the next time he runs. And we watched the films at night and all of that. And I said, yeah, I can see what you're saying. It definitely is a horse that needs to be claimed. And it turns out he was an absolutely beautiful horse on top of it. And perfect confirmation, great looking horse, beautiful rear end, everything that I like to see in a horse. And so we claimed him, and he won a few races for us, and he has a couple interesting stories about Pewter Gray. As he was getting ready for the Sierra Nevada Handicap, which was the grade three that he won here at Santa Anita, the race before, it came up muddy. Shoemaker was on him, and they were going into the first turn, and all of a sudden he took off with Bill. And he kind of ran off around the first turn, and Bill was really struggling to keep him back, you know. And he came back. He finished second in the race, and he came back, and he said, Jude, he said, we would have won, but something happened. And I said, well, Lee Rossi's horse bit him on the ass going into the first turn. And he didn't believe me. So Shu and I went and watched the films, and sure enough, Lee's horse took a chunk out of his butt, and he took off from that, and it cost him the race. But then that set him up for the next one.
Great stuff. To all part of the lore, the legend, the mystique that is thoroughbred racing.
That's right.
You're part of it now.
Yeah, I'm part of it.
And so is Ron Ellis, and he is back with us here on Trainer Talk on the Final Furlong here on HRRN. And Ron, glad to have you back with us, my friend. Take us back from the beginning again. We kind of lost you there. You mentioned that you went to the track, 15 is when you first got involved?
Yeah, hey guys, sorry about that. I'm just driving through a part of L.A. I don't get reception. But anyway, I should be good now. I had a neighbor. I had never been to the races, and I had a neighbor who lived across the street, asked if I wanted to go to the races one day, and I said, yeah, I've never been, but sure, I'll go. And I had the best time. He showed me how to read the form. I picked a couple winners. Thought that was the best thing ever. So mentioned it to my dad, and he mentioned it to a coworker that owned a part of a horse with a trainer named Larry Sterling. And so we went out and visited the barn. And for me, it was like going into an NFL locker room and getting to meet the athletes, you know. I'd always loved horses, and these were the most beautiful horse I'd ever seen. So Larry was kind enough to say if I wanted to work there on the weekends, that would be great, and in the summers. So it really started for me almost as a summer job, hot walking horses at 15. And, you know, it just kind of went from there. I was fortunate to work for Larry for 5 years. He was a tremendous horseman, and he taught me everything he knew in those 5 years. And when I got an opportunity to train my first horse in 1980 at 20 years old, luckily we were able to make the best of it, a horse called To Be or Not. He was the best sprinter in California for the next 3 years. So.
Yeah, I always remember I was a one-horse stable, and I had Sam Dell's Lark, which was she was a $10,000 claimer, and I'd go sit over with you as you were doing To Be or Not up and sit and talk to you. You were on the other side of the shed row for me and try to convince you to get your trainer's license. I always used to tell you, if I can do this, you should be able to do it. And it wasn't long after that that you got your license, and you actually, your first horse was To Be or Not, a terrific horse.
Yeah, he was really a good sprinter. You know, he was a horse that Larry Sterling had trained as a three-year-old and had won a couple of stake races with him. And then he and the owner went different ways when To Be or Not was a four-year-old. And the horse had a... never did win a race for the new trainer. So Carol Baum had asked Larry if he'd take the horse back, and he said, absolutely not. So I just kind of put it in her ear. I said, well, I groomed that horse when he was here. I know him pretty well. Why don't you give me a shot with him? And I think she fell out of options and said, well, all right. So I didn't give up my day job working with Larry as a groom then, because I didn't know how that all would work out. But it worked out pretty well. I was very fortunate.
Ron, you mentioned Larry Sterling, and you talk about the influence that he had on you in the early years. What are some of the things that you learned from him that you still incorporate into your practice today?
Well, I was very fortunate that Larry had a wide array of horses. He trained for W.R. Hahn, who was a pretty big breeder, but Larry also had his share of climbing horses. So I kind of got to see the full gamut of how to take care of horses and what to do. When I first started working for Larry in the first year of Vigers, if you remember back to him, turned out to be a top handicap horse in the country. He was a two-year-old, and in fact, he was the first horse that they gave me to walk, and he promptly reared up and got loose from me, and I said, what are you giving me the best horse in the barn for? They knew it as a two-year-old that he was a good one. And back then, people took things a little bit differently. You know, the horses were just horses, and now they're valuable commodities. But they thought it was a pretty good joke. They knew he'd get loose from me and weren't too worried about that. But what I learned from Larry was how to take care of horses, how to develop them, and how to bring them along, because I did get to see Vigers go from just a young Gox two-year-old into the top handicap horse that he was.
Well, he turned out to be a sensational horse, and Larry was a real even keel guy. He didn't get too upset about anything, and I think that kind of carries over to you too. You take things in stride. You had a horse named Rail Trip taken away from you, but you were smart enough to say yes when they asked to take it back.
Yeah, well, I wasn't going to make that mistake, I can tell you that. But, there was quite an incident, and I was very excited when Sam last December, Samantha Siegel, asked me if I would take him back, and I said, of course I will, gladly. And luckily, still got some run left in those old legs.
Yeah, since you took us down the Rail Trip road here, talk to us about Rail Trip and how he's doing and coming up to another race here, another big one on Saturday.
Well, he's really, really doing well. I mean, he worked phenomenally here on Monday over the Hollywood Strip, 59-3, and he did that all on his own. I mean, as the grading race workouts around here go, I'd give him an A workout for sure. When he's being an upper age a little bit, and the way I usually train, I kind of bring horses around off layoff, to get better with each start. And when he won the San Diego Handicap, I knew he was probably one more good race away from being able to take on the likes of a Game On Dude and some of those, you know, top older horses out here. But, you know, timing didn't allow for that, so we went ahead and raced him in the Pacific Classic. I really think more than getting outrun, I really think he just got tired. He was stalking in a good spot until they hit the head of the lane, and then you could see that he just didn't have the kick to go on by those good horses. But he never gave up, and I was very proud of him for that. And, you know, out of the race, he seems like he's gotten stronger. I really like being able to shorten up to the mile and an eighth. It's going to let me know whether we should go to the Breeders' Cup Mile or the Breeders' Cup, you know, Classic. And this is going to be his first start on natural dirt for me. He's run at Santa Anita before, but that's when it was a synthetic racetrack. I think he's going to be just fine. I think if he's not as good, maybe he might even improve a little bit over the surface. But, you know, we'll let him show us on Saturday what to do with him.
And you talk about getting horses where you can get them better with each start, kind of let them come up to a peak. Talk about that philosophy, Ron, that you have in terms of training horses overall, not just off the layoff, but what are some of your philosophies that you've instilled to have so much success over the years?
Well, I mean, I that is one of them. I mean, whether I'm dealing with a young horse or a horse off of a layoff, I really don't look for them to, you know, fire their best shot first time out or first time off of a layoff. That doesn't mean they can't do it. I mean, good horses will surprise you at times and do things. You know, Zenyatta, the way John Sheriff handled her, I thought was just masterful. But she broke her maiden going 6 furlongs. And, you know, good horses can do things that you don't expect of them. But usually I just like to see a nice run out of a horse first time out and leave something, you know, to get better each time. And I think you could follow my horses and see that usually happen. And then the other thing is I don't see any reason in running a horse that's not reasonably sound. If they're hurting, for me, they're not going to run very well. And that really comes into play with the good horses and the top horses. I don't believe that you can push them one race past when they're starting to get an injury, because once you do, I think you've compromised them for life. And I think that's why I have horses that, you know, come back and put 2 and 3 years worth of racing in together. You can go back in my history, and whether you're talking about a filly like Twice of Ice or Exotic Wood or, you know, just go back and look at any of them. A lot of them put several years together, because I just don't believe that they can run hurt at a top level.
Yeah, there's no question about it, especially in graded races. You can't get away with running a horse that has any issues. I mean, there's just too many other horses out to win those super prizes, and so it does make sense. But you see it happen once in a while, that you see somebody pushing a horse and you just wonder, why are they doing that? But you never see that with a Ron Ellis horse. That's one thing that is ironclad rule with you, I know, is that you just don't push them. If they're not 100%, you're not running them, and that's a real feather in your cap.
Well, you know, a lot of that goes back to the clients that I've had too, Jude. You know, when you have faith that your clients are going to let you turn a horse out and you're going to get it back, it's a lot easier to do. You know, I think that so many people run scared because they're afraid to tell their owner that the horse needs some time off, especially a top racehorse. You know, it's a big disappointment to everybody, but I think a lot of trainers are afraid to say something and go one race too early, then one race too late, because they're afraid they're not going to get the horse back. And I think that's a real concern. I've been very fortunate. As you know, I've trained to the Seagulls for 20-something years. And, you know, I don't just take clients that are the bounce-around type clients, because I would have the same concern. You know, if I turn this horse out, am I going to be the one that gets him back? And in a lot of cases, you would. So a lot of my training, I can put faith in the ownership is going to give me back the horse to train when they are back 100%.
Talking with trainer Ron Ellis here on Trainer Talk on the Final Furlong on Horse Racing Radio Network. Ron, you mentioned, you know, especially if the horse is a tough horse, you just use those words. Who might be the toughest horse that you've ever had the privilege, I guess, of being around?
Well, the toughest horse would definitely be a couple of the claiming horses that I've had. I mean, I'd go back to a filly that you've never heard of, but a filly named Kalanin's Laugh that, you know, always physically never seemed to be right, but yet she put eight races, I claimed her originally for $25,000, and she put eight wins together in a row over a two-year span. But I remember one race, that she, one allowance race that she won, she got bumped very hard in the first turn and put her last when she's used to being on the lead. She ended up winning the race and then couldn't cool out afterwards because she had fractured her tandem bone, and that mishap in the first turn. But after a year layoff, she came back and won an allowance race and won a stake. And, you know, those are the kind that you really say, wow. Now, I mean, nobody's ever going to hear of them in the end, and they're not going to go down in history, but she was definitely the toughest racehorse that I've ever trained. The most talented racehorse for me, hands down, that I've ever trained was Declan's Moon. He never really got a chance to finish off what he had started. You know, he started his career 6-for-6. He was either the favorite, pre-favorite for the Derby. He won his first race as a three-year-old after being two-year-old champion. And unfortunately, he ran at Santa Anita on one of those sealed wet racetracks. And when he did win as a three-year-old, and he came out of it with a chip in his knee, but he never was right after surgery. He couldn't really breathe, and people just really didn't get to see the talent that that racehorse has.
You've come awful close to the Kentucky Derby a couple of times. You've even been in the frame, as they say. Do you still get Derby fever, or do you worry about it? Do you think about it? Are you hopeful that someday you'll get there? What's your feeling on the Kentucky Derby?
Well, as you know, Jude, I'm married to a Louisville girl.
And, right, and one of the all-time great Louisville girls.
Well, and she makes sure that that I'm thinking Derby all the time with anything. So, you know, one time I mentioned when Serena Song was trying to get ready, whether she was going to, Lucas was trying to decide whether to run her in the Oaks or the Derby, and I told my wife, I said, why doesn't he just win the Oaks with her? That'd be just as good as winning the Derby. She told me she would never repeat that I said that to anybody because it was such a stupid thing. But, you know, I have been close. I really thought that that's what I'm talking about. He was the horse for me. He ran a bang-up for us. If you watch the replay, especially on the aerial shot that they have from the blimp, I mean, he got stopped on the backside two or three times, and finally he knocked horses out of the way at the quarter pole and made a charge that, you know, three, four more strides, we're going to catch Funny Side. He was beaten neck for second by Empire Maker, and, you know, that was disappointing, but I'm sure, you know, almost everybody has a closing story in the Derby like that. You know, it's a tough race to come from behind, and they do get in trouble. But, you know, I've been there twice. I was also fourth with Don't Get Mad. He wasn't as close to fourth, but he ran a good race. And, you know, being there and running fourth a couple times, you realize it's an attainable goal. It can happen, you know. And I deal with clients that want to get there, and I'm hoping to get there. But, you know, you say all the pieces have to fall right. You got to have the right horse, and we'll get back there someday, but hopefully sooner than later.
Well, I know if That's What I'm Talking About would have won the Derby, your brothers-in-law and myself and my brother, well, none of us would be here now. We'd all be in some island somewhere having cocktails and walking the beach, because we were alive to everything, to that horse, and yeah. It was going to be hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Well, you know, you mentioned that, and it's funny because my brother-in-law, Paul McGee, who's a trainer in Kentucky, he won the race just before that. At the time, it was the early time, a mile on the grass, and his horse paid 80-something bucks. And then my other brother-in-law, Marty McGee, who writes for the Forum, he had such a big bet that he was going to make way more money than me if That's What I'm Talking About had a one. And there was some kind of pissed me off about that. I said, wait a second, I've been working on this horse a year. You're going to make more than me in 2 days. And I said, believe me, I was still rooting for him, but there was just something that didn't seem right about that.
A little jealous, huh? Yeah. Well, there were a few of us that were alive for some big money that day. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. But it's always great to have a horse. I never really had a Derby fever. I had more of a Derby sniffle. But I remember when Ready to Order beat Cavaneer a couple times, I thought, you know, this would be the one, and unfortunately he stepped on a shoe that some horse had blown here at Santa Anita on the training track and bruised his foot, and he never got to run in the Kentucky Derby. But somebody had asked me before if I won the Derby, what would I do? And I said, well, I would retire that day and give the horse to Ron Ellis. I said, Ron will end up winning the next two Triple Crowns with the next two Triple Crown races with that horse, because I won't be here. I will just quit.
Well, I
so you almost came close to a third time.
I do appreciate that for certain.
You were talking about your brothers-in-law. Tell us about your family. I was bragging on you earlier before we came on the air about your family and how close you are. I understand you were picking up your daughter at school. You know, talk about your family a little bit.
Well, yeah, I was. As I was picking up my middle daughter, Laura, she just turned 16. She's getting ready to drive, but doesn't quite drive yet. And you know, Sacred Heart is up on that hill. It's a little dangerous. So I've been a protective father. Wait until she's mastered this driving before she gets to drive herself. But that's why my reception was so bad. But, you know, my wife, Amy, from Louisville, her dad took her to the races when she was, 4, 5, 6 years old, her and her old brothers and sisters. And she tells the story about when it was dad's turn to babysit, it was right straight to the races. And he would tell them that, no treats, no ice cream or popcorn or anything unless dad's horse wins. So you had four kids, Marty, the oldest, Paul, McGee, Susan, her older sister, and then Amy, all running down the stretch rooting for the horses so they could get treats. And that's how that family became a big, you know, fan-oriented horse race family. And then it kind of branched off from there to where Marty became a rider for the Racing Form. Paul's a very successful trainer in Kentucky. Susan, she used to run the turf club at Hollywood Park when she lived in California, but she went off and had four kids. So they moved back to Kentucky, and she's got her hands full being a full-time mom. And then Amy, she does some real estate, and she's busy raising our three daughters. My oldest one, Elizabeth, who, as you know, has been dating Joe Talamo for about 5 or 6 years here, and they make a pretty good team. And she just graduated from college in 3 years from Chapman, which I'm very proud of, and she's going to go on and do some television work. And then our youngest one, Christine, which is our bonus baby, she's 6 years old and just starting kindergarten. So we got a kind of a wide array of age groups, and I always say I'm never going to leave the house looking like a dork, because I'm always going to be hip with the age group of girls that I have watching.
There you go. You get no dark socks with shorts or any of that stuff going on there with Ron Ellis.
that's right.
Ron, you mentioned your daughter Elizabeth and Joe Talamo and their relationship. Joe joined us earlier on the show. He was outstanding, always a great interview, a great kid. We followed him from when he first started riding as an apprentice down in Louisiana. But I'm curious what that's like when Joe Talamo rides for you, and let's say he doesn't give a horse a particularly good ride and you have to come down hard on Joe. What's that like with Elizabeth?
Well, you know, it's been a little bit of a struggle, to be quite honest with you. You know, first off, I mean, you got to remember, Joe's been out here about, 5, 6 years now. But he was out here when he was 16. But I was, you know, I rode him a little bit early on, and we had some success. And then we had a couple of rides that were a little bit on the questionable side, as you're going to get from any apprentice. And things would be a little quiet around the house. Joe was kind of, you know, afraid to come by, so it was very tentative. So I actually stopped riding him for a while, because I thought it was having an effect on his confidence and from him to be away from the racetrack and come over to the house. I mean, I love Joe as a person. I cannot think of a better person than Joe Talamo, but it got a little rough around the house if I was a little mad at him, you know. And I'm sure Jude can attest for the last thing you want to do is, you know, be nice to a jockey in your house after a bad ride. And it's going to happen with all of them, you know. So I literally did stop riding him, but, Joe is such a good rider, and he's really making huge strides at his young age, improving all the time. And, I ride him now, and if he makes a mistake, I think he's professional enough that he can take some criticism. He might not agree with me. You know, I was very vocal about his ride on Include Me Out in the Vanity at Hollywood. And he didn't think that he moved too early. I thought he moved way too early. But, you know, now we're both just taking it as I can dish the criticism out. He can take it or not take it. But we get along a lot better off the track, even if something doesn't go right.
And he's back aboard Include Me Out on Saturday afternoon, the first running of the Zenyatta Stakes, a race formerly known as the Lady's Secret. And we talked about Rail Trip. Tell us about Include Me Out and how she's doing coming up to this one.
Well, she's doing really well and surprisingly well. And I say that because she has had such a long year. She was, she started out, she broke her maiden at Del Mar last year, and she's gone straight through, and, she's had a solid campaign, and, luckily her races the second half of the year have been spaced to where she's had 2 months in between races and, 5 weeks and 2 months, and it's just been well, but, you know, she's had a long year, and she's hung in there, and she's a tough little girl, and she worked great the other day, so she doesn't seem like she's tailing off to me. But, I keep waiting for her. My big thing is just keeping enough weight on her. She was keeping weight. She kept her weight a little bit heavier early on in the year. She's kind of lean and mean right now, but, she doesn't act like she's tailing off to me at all, and I think she's coming in the race well.
Yeah, she had a best of the morning work on the turf at Santa Anita on September the 22nd, and she just keeps firing. I mean, what a nice group of races there. If you throw the Vanity out, which it sounds like you might have had pilot error, she'd be undefeated. I mean, that's just a fantastic skein of races. And I know, a lot of people don't pay a lot of attention to her, but she's a really, really good filly.
Well, she is, June, and really, when you look at her record, that's the only mark on it, especially once she's been around two turns. She was getting beaten sprinting by my other real good filly, Teddy's Promise. I don't think any embarrassment in that since she's a Grade One winner. But her record is pretty impeccable, other than that mark at Hollywood Park. I think that, like I said, Joe, I think, got a little excited in there. He told me that he looked back at one point and that the eventual winner was so far back, he thought there was no way that she could, get to him. And she drew out by six. And then she got to goofing around. I mean, she pulls herself up when she gets to the front. And, that's the only thing that happened. But I did an NTRA interview yesterday that, I kind of said I've been a little insulted by the press and the lack of attention that she's gotten, because she's proven to be the best in the West Coast. The filly she beat last time at Del Mar is a Grade One winner, Star Billing, legitimate filly. And I just think she's gotten a lack of respect, and I really don't understand it, to tell you the truth.
Well, we hear a lot in sports anyways about an East Coast bias. Is there an East Coast bias in horse racing, Ron? You're a California guy. Is there an East Coast bias?
That's a rhetorical question, right? Yeah, I think everybody on the East Coast feels like on the West Coast feels like there's an East Coast bias. There's no question about it. And, we really take great pride and pleasure when our horses ship from here and go back east and, kind of put a spanking on some of those big-name East Coast horses. And I can go right down the list of a lot of the horses that, Plum Pretty won the the apple blossom. A lot of our horses usually come from here when the apple blossom, but they don't get the credit that they deserve when they do go back. And until they do go back there and prove it, we're in front of them. And, you know, we've been through it before. I think it's kind of we talk about it tongue-in-cheek, but there's no question there's an East Coast bias. And I think there's an East Coast bias when it comes to even some of the numbers. You know, you see the buyer figures. You know, they never hardly give horses out here the 108, 112, 120s, whatever they are. But they do quite a bit on the East Coast. And then when the horses meet up, the numbers really show not to mean that much.
Well, the guy that's got the biggest paddle, obviously, is Baffert, because he goes back there and spanks their ass with regularity. And being,
right,
you know, a West Coast guy that's now, you know, moved to an East Coast guy, so to speak, even though I live in Kentucky now, you know, you always gravitate to the horses that you see. And one of the things that I think California has working against it is the 3-hour time difference. Because a lot of people, you know, they're out to dinner when the big races are running here, and they don't get to see these horses. And
right.
And that's a big issue when you're going to vote for Breeders' Cup and all that. And I always try to encourage people, and we're very lucky because we get to travel around the country and see these horses. I'm real excited to see the races here on Saturday, because I'm actually going to get to see these horses up close and personal, see what they look like on the racetrack, you know, see how they run, and I'm going to have a lot better view of who's good and who's bad than people who just, you know, are watching horses that run in our neck of the woods all the time. So I think that's a real problem for California. And you know, maybe some of the better races should be run a little bit earlier. I don't know. I don't know how you get around that, really. But it is something that happens, and I understand it now a little bit more than I live on the East Coast after spending lots of nights watching the Lakers till 1 o'clock in the morning and staying up to watch baseball games and football games till midnight. You know, it's pretty rough. You know.
Yeah.
You got to be dedicated.
I think that's a very good point, and I do think that's part of the problem. Well, the other problem, I think, is, you know, we're kind of an island out here in California. I mean, we run against the same horses that are out here in California, and we don't really get an array of horses coming from, you know, different places, Maryland, Pennsylvania, New York, and a lot of these horses are meeting each other, and a lot of the horses get opportunities to win, you know, graded stakes and then go and hook up with each other, whereas, like, a great example was Zenyatta. Zenyatta was out here, you know, for 3 years. She won every grade one there was. So the knock against her was, well, she never beats a grade one winner. Well, how's there going to be any grade one winners when she won them all? So,
yeah,
you know, horses back east could win a grade one maybe, you know, in Maryland and then go to New York, and then a New York horse beats a grade one winner. Out here we're kind of on an island, and you know, you don't really get the some of these other horses that are finishing second and third could be legitimate, you know, graded stake winners, but they just have to run against the same tough horses all the time.
Trainer Ron Ellis joining us here on the inaugural Trainer Talk edition of the Final Furlong Show here on HRRN. Ron, you get those East Coast horses coming west November 2nd and 3rd for the Breeders' Cup World Championships. How significant, how big of a home field advantage is that for all the West Coast-based horses?
Well, I think history has shown that it's a very big advantage. A lot of the New York horses, when they came out to Santa Anita for the last Breeders' Cup, didn't really show up much. Now, I think it was a synthetic racetrack back then, but, you know, even when it was a dirt racetrack, a lot of the New York horses don't really like the little bit firmer surfaces out here. The Santa Anita track is very good shape. I think it's going to be a little bit more on an East Coast type of track. They put a lot of very good quality sand in the racetrack. We've had some very, very hot record-setting temperatures out here the last couple of weeks, and the track's been a little bit loose because they couldn't keep enough water on it. We don't have the humidity that they do back east, so the track dries out very quickly. But I think if the temperatures cool down a little bit and they can really pour the water to this racetrack, it might be a touch more like an East Coast racetrack, but still, it's going to lean towards being a little on the firm side. And that's why I'm excited about Include Me Out. She loves the racetrack the way it is at Santa Anita, and it's a big advantage. Even though she doesn't train here, she trains at Betfair Hollywood Park. But, you know, she's shown a liking for the track. And I see that as a big advantage.
Ron, you talked about your philosophy of training horses and your philosophy of bringing horses back off the layoff, but you've had so much success with younger horses. Declan's Moon comes to mind, for example. Talk about your philosophy when you go to the sales. I know you're at all the major horse sales around the country. When you go to the sales, picking out horses, what are some of the things that you're looking for that you think will make a really good racehorse?
Well, I think for my liking, I like a yearling that kind of looks like a yearling. I don't want him to look like a ready-made racehorse as a one-year-old because, you know, as people do, they're going to fill out and they're going to bulk up as they get older. So I look for kind of a little bit lighter-made horse, but, you know, with a little bit of leg. I like him to be a little bit on the leggier, taller side because, for me, I'm looking for that mile and a quarter horse. I'm not looking for that sprinter. So I basically, when I'm buying horses for clients, I kind of throw out anything that's bred just to be a speed horse. I throw out anything that looks like they're just a very fast horse. And I look for a little bit more of a classic, more elegant yearling than I do one that looks like he's going to roar down there, you know, in 107 and 2 or something along those lines.
You know, Jude was telling me a story last night about one of the horses that he trained, and the horse was so mean that he would get out on the racetrack and just kind of sit down he wouldn't move anywhere. And I'm curious to know maybe who the meanest horse is that you ever trained.
Oh, you know, that it probably would be a filly. I've had a couple fillies that are just really, really ornery, and it seems like it's really hard to straighten them out. You know, we can't geld a filly, so we've got to just kind of put up with what they are. And, you know, I had a filly once that my wife used to get a big kick out of. I actually used to have to jog with her to the gate to get her to go to the gate with a rider on her because she wouldn't go. She'd plant in the races, she'd plant herself, and the rider, I actually rode my exercise rider because he would hop off of her and we'd run, you know, for about an eighth of a mile, then he'd hop back on her and then she'd stop and he'd jump off and we'd run with her. And we almost had to do that all the way to the gate, and it got to be quite a deal. And once she got in the gate and they opened it, she'd go wire to wire and she'd win. But eventually she ended up getting ruled off. The trainers complained that she wasn't carrying weight to the gate and all sorts of things. And she just wouldn't go once the rider was on her back. Philly, her name was Dreaming Bell, but like I said, another one you've never heard of, but they can get the fillies are the ones that have given me the most quirkiness, really.
Yeah, sometimes the horses that are the toughest and the cheapest, you do your best training jobs on. I had a horse too that I used to have to run alongside. I don't know if you remember him or not, Roosevelt Road. He wouldn't gallop, and he was an old gelding, but he wouldn't gallop unless you ran alongside of him. And one day Bobby Frankel said to me, "You better get rid of that horse. He can't outrun a fat man."
That's good. I like that.
Ron, how about the one horse?
You're right, Jude. I mean, a lot of the best training jobs that we do is generally with horses that people really will never hear of.
Ron, how about the one horse that you'd like to have back? If you could have one horse back and say, you know what, this horse was so good and so close and just never quite got over the hump, who would that one horse be?
Well, like I said, Declan's Moon to me, it's just sad. It goes back to... I would have never run him that day. You know, after being champion 2 year old, I had planned on just kind of a lighter campaign going into the Kentucky Derby. I planned on just running him twice, and then running the Derby. And it rained the day before his race was to be run, and then it was threatening rain the day he was supposed to run. And I begged the track man to open it up to a normal level instead of having it like a sealed racetrack because I knew the consequences of that. And, you know, obviously looking back in the 2020, I would have just scratched and figured out some other way to get to the Derby. But because he was such a sound horse up until that point. But, you know, you run him on a bad racetrack and you really got to cross your fingers and hope that that things work out okay. And in this case, it didn't. But he is one that I really think, I've never talked about a horse. People asked me about that horse when he was two, and I said, this is not a good horse. This is a great horse. This is the type of horse that goes down, you know, in all-time categories. And people looked at me because they know I'm conservative by nature. I don't usually talk like that. But believe me, that horse was the title. He had the talent to be one of those kind of horses that is legendary. And unfortunately, because of an injury, he didn't get a chance to show that.
Yeah, that is a very uncharacteristic comment by Ron Ellis to just say this horse is great and legendary, because you are about as low key on horses as it gets. I mean, I think only Buster Milrick was probably lower key on horses than you. you never get too high about him.
Got to be our age to know who Buster Milrick was, pretty much, Jade. You know.
Yeah, well, you know, I spent a long time trying to get him into the Hall of Fame, and that was one of the happiest days of my life when they finally elected him a couple of years ago. He was a great trainer, and he was a mentor to so many trainers. Las Barrera said he was his idol, and Buster Milrick was one of the main reasons that Las came from Cuba to train horses, because he wanted to be like Buster Milrick, and I know Bobby Frankel idolized him, and you and I were lucky. We kind of got there at the tail end of his career, but anybody that spent any time around Buster knew what a great horse trainer he was, and he certainly deserved to be in the Hall of Fame. And I was lucky enough to be there this year when Bob Wheeler got inducted into the Hall of Fame, and you know, Bob Wheeler was another guy that really helped a lot of people on the racetrack. He, if you ever had a question about a horse or anything, he was more than happy to share his knowledge, and just an all-around great guy as well as a fantastic trainer. And I was quite happy to be there for that ceremony this year.
Yeah, where'd all those guys go?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, maybe you're the next one. I mean, maybe you're the guy that people look up to. You know, because there's not too many guys anymore that, you know, are hay oats and water guys that go out there and do the job every day and really spend a lot of time. You know, I mean, Ron McAnally is getting up there in years. I mean, he's one of the few stalwarts left. But I mean, yeah, most of them are dead, and it's kind of depressing, you know, sometimes to think about it, because we were really lucky to be in that heyday when there were some really great trainers here, Charlie Whittingham and Las Barrera, Bobby Frankel, Buster Milrick. I mean, we kind of got in at the tail end of all of that, you know, and it was so great early days when we trained. It was just like the who's who of horse racing on the backside here.
Yeah, it was a lot different game, and that's one of my, you know, I'm starting to sound like an old guy, you know, talking like the good old days or whatever, but I don't know. I just, you know, I've always had a philosophy that if I'm going to train a horse, I'm going to see him train every day. And that kind of came from Charlie Whittingham. That's what he said, and that's what he believed. And, you know, that whole ball game has changed now. It's become so that stables are a little bit more on the factory-oriented side. And, you know, the stars are the only ones that matter, and we've got to go through a couple hundred to get those stars. And it's just the game has changed quite a bit from that standpoint. But, you know, I'm happy with the numbers I have and with what goes on. And I'm like I said, I'm of that philosophy. If I'm going to train a horse, I'm going to watch him train every day. And that's just something that's kind of passed by. And, you know, Richard Mandela and Ron McAnally, like you said, they fall in that category. But, you know, they're kind of on the outer end thing.
Oh, Ron, time flies. Hard to believe just a few minutes left here in the very first Trainer Talk show here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. You've been very, very gracious with your time. We can't thank you enough for helping us kick off this weekly show, and no better way to do it than with somebody like yourself. Talk about what and people also know you as a broadcaster on TVG, and you do a tremendous job with that as well. Talk about that side of your life and what that's meant to you as well.
Oh, well, thanks. I appreciate that. Yeah, you know, it's more of a sideline for me. It's kind of a diversion a little bit. You know, it's a break from the monotony, so to speak, of the training. You know, you get up in 7 days a week early and you're working with the horses and everything. It's kind of a different side, and I find it to be fun and almost, you know, kind of relaxing, really. And it's been good. I guess there's a part of me that tries to make up for the not-so-good job I did on the NTRA NTRA championship race on Fox. You know, they approached me and asked me if I'd do those Fox Network shows, and I had never done any TV at all. They just picked me off of interviews, and I said, yeah, sure, I'll do it, no problem. Well, the next thing you know, I'm standing next to Joe Buck and Kenny Albert and, you know, guys that are just at the top of the broadcasting ball game. And, I mean, I was a nervous wreck, and I never really was happy with the job that I did on there. I was fortunate that the producer, Pete Macheska, put me on tape a lot, and then, you know, I didn't look so bad, but I don't know if a lot of that comes from wanting to make up, because now television, I find, is just a matter of repetition and doing it, getting comfortable in front of the camera. And that is one thing I can say. I'm pretty good now. I'm pretty comfortable in front of a camera. But mostly I do the TVG work. I just fill in for them when they need somebody on a freelance basis. And it's mostly a fun thing for me to do.
Well, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. We're very proud to have Elizabeth as part of our coverage. She did a great job for us down at the Pacific Classic. She's going to be doing our paddock interviews and stuff this weekend. So she's learning from one of the best.
Well, thanks. Yeah, I'm very proud of Elizabeth. She's worked very hard. She's come a long way. She's very, inventive in things she does. But, you know, she really loves the horse racing, and I just didn't want her to end up on the backside. So I think this is a good compromise, for her, and it's something that she can take wherever she wants. And then if she wants to do something else, she can always go that direction and have that experience. But she does love horse racing, and I think this is a great way for her to be involved in it.
Yeah, I was just surprised that she picked Rail Trip in that race.
Usually Joe must not have had a mount in there. That's all I can say.
yeah, she is a bit of a homer, but
yeah.
Trainer Ron Ellis is.
Believe me, all my daughters go Joe Salamo first, and then to me. So it gets a little uncomfortable when Christine, my 6-year-old, is cheering for Joe, and I've got Samantha Siegel in the box, and Joe's not on our horse, so that's a little uncomfortable. When it's
the
Joe,
problems of being
Joe, and it's like,
that's a great story. That's a great story.
Trainer Ron Ellis, our special guest here on Trainer Talk on the Final Furlong on HRRN. And Ron, thank you so much for being with us again. We couldn't have picked a better guest to kick things off with here, and all the best this weekend with Rail Trip and with Include Me Out, and along the road to the Breeders' Cup as well.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, we've got Casino Host in on Sunday, too. Kind of excited about him for the mile and a half. He's already a win and you're in, too. So, looking forward to all that. But I appreciate it. Anytime you guys want, I'm always happy to come on.
Thank you so much, and good luck. We'll be rooting for you.
Okay, thanks a lot, guys.
Thanks, Ron. Trainer Ron Ellis helping us kick things off here on the all-new Final Furlong Show. Again, every Wednesday this show will be dedicated to trainer talk. We'll take you inside with some discussion with different trainers and talk to them about things outside of horse racing as well. You can tell there's a lot more to Ron Ellis than just horses.
Yeah, we didn't even get into the sports. It's amazing how fast an hour goes.
Yeah, no commercial breaks either.
Yeah, I know.
Not a single one.
We were on a roll. That's all right. Who needs money? It was great to talk to Ron, and I think the listeners probably got a good insight to who he is and what makes him tick. And so that's what this show's all about. That's what we're going to try to do. We're going to try to let you inside the trainer's mind and inside their life, and hopefully we'll have some people that are as gracious as Ron and want to hang in there for a whole hour and do that, or maybe we'll split it up with two trainers depending on scheduling. But I'm quite pleased with the way Ron handled everything today. It was great stuff. He's a pro.
And of course, tomorrow, this last hour of the program from 6 to 7 Eastern will be your opportunity to call in. Let us know what you think of anything pertaining to horse racing. We'll take your phone calls. You can call into our HRN studios. Let us know what you think. If you want to talk about the prep races, we can do that. If you want to talk about any issues pertaining to racing, we'll be here for you tomorrow afternoon. It's all about you, the listener, from 6 to 7 Eastern time. We are back 3 o'clock Eastern tomorrow, though, with our HRN live coverage, 3 to 6, and then the call-in show from 6 to 7. So it'll be a lot of fun. You can visit hrnlive.com to get more information on that and a complete schedule. Also, check out our main website, horseracingradio.net. It's about going to do it for us here this afternoon from Santa Anita. For our producer back in our Lexington, Kentucky studios, Lee Delapina, doing a great job today. Jude Feld, I am Mike Penna. We will talk to you tomorrow afternoon, 3 o'clock Eastern Time, here on HRRN. So long from Santa Anita.
Good night, Barbados.
You're listening to The Final Furlong on HRRN Live.